Al Jazeera Podcasts.
Today, pro-Palestinian voices on U.S. college campuses say they're being silenced.
Columbia University has been very complicit and biased because Columbia University administration has picked a side early on since October 7th.
I'm Malika Bilal, and this is The Take. Columbia University is known worldwide for its academics and for its location, an Ivy League school right in the heart of New York City. On April 17th, the school made headlines for other reasons.
Demonstrators set up tents earlier today, which ballooned into hundreds of people. The group was told to disband by 4 p.m., but they did not.
First, before dawn, students set up an encampment on the university's lawn in the middle of campus. That same day, the university president, Nimat Manush Shafiq, was in Washington. The U.S. Congress questioned Shafiq about allegations of anti-Semitism on Columbia's campus, making her the latest in a line of elite college heads to be summoned.
Columbia strives to be a community free of discrimination and hate in all its forms, and we condemn the anti-Semitism that is so pervasive today.
The next day, in New York, Shafiq called on police to try to clear the Columbia protesters off the school lawn. It set off a confrontation that's still reverberating now. And as the university tries to shut down its encampment, others are popping up at least a dozen universities across the United States.
Tensions are high at elite schools across the U.S., with similar scenes of protesting at the new school, Yale and MIT, all sparked by the unbelievable sights of tents on the lawns of Columbia University.
Today, we're beginning a two-part series on what's happened at Columbia. And we're starting with something that happened earlier this year, when protesters say things escalated. On a snowy Friday in January, around 100 students gathered at Columbia University in New York. They'd been meeting regularly since October to protest Israel's war on Gaza.
The revolution has begun!
But this time, as the protesters walked up the steps of the university's main library, something happened. Students say they were sprayed with a chemical, something that smelled terrible, which they say would later make their eyes and skin burn.
It smelled like raw sewage. Like, when I was there, I was like, oh my gosh, it smells like somebody was dying. Like, it was horrible.
It was reminiscent of something called skunk, which has been used by Israeli military forces on Palestinians. College campuses have become a flashpoint in U.S. debates over policy towards Israel and Palestine ever since the start of the war. College administrations have been suspending pro-Palestinian student groups across the country.
Columbia University is suspending two student groups that are vocal on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
At least 18 students at Pomona College now facing suspension after participating in a pro-Palestinian protest on campus.
But the allegation that a chemical spray was used on student protesters is something new. It's also something Asya Ahmed, a senior producer for AJ Plus, investigated for a recent documentary. Pro-Palestinian students told Asya they believe two students infiltrated their protests to commit the alleged attack. And the documentary was able to identify the two as former members of the Israeli military.
It's one thing for there to be, you know, disciplinary hearings or banning student groups. And it's another thing for students to be suffering an alleged chemical attack on a U.S. university campus.
Asya spoke to several students affected by the alleged attack, including one Palestinian-American student named Layla, who you heard from earlier.
Like, right after I attended the protest, I felt so sick. I kept on throwing up. I was
my headache. I had a headache that would not go away. My eyes were burning. And I was just like, this is not normal. Like, something is wrong here.
Layla was one of at least 10 students who sought medical attention over their symptoms in the days after the alleged attack.
This is a note that I got from the doctor. So the diagnosis I got was exposure to potentially hazardous chemical. And the symptoms I was experiencing include nausea, fatigue, vomiting, headache, loss of appetite.
Columbia's administration denied a request from AJ Plus for an interview about what measures they're taking to ensure student safety on campus. But some students say the incident fits into a broader culture of repression, a pro-Palestinian sentiment.
Columbia University has become a partner in this oppression and ongoing genocide.
That's Mohsen Mahdawi, a student at Columbia and the co-president of the university's Palestinian Students Union.
Columbia has systematically discriminated against us and prevented us in many different ways from raising our voices and from protesting this genocide that is unfolding. I mean, they have shut our events down. They have sanctioned our students. They have allowed attacks by professors and by students against our movements without holding anybody accountable.
In the early days of the war, a speech from someone named Shai Davidai went viral. He's an assistant professor at Columbia's business school, and he labeled groups like Mohsen's pro-terror student organizations.
And I want you to know, we cannot protect your children from pro-terror student organizations because the president of Columbia University will not speak out.
The official X account for the State of Israel tweeted out the video. Their tweet alone received more than 5 million views. Davidai has also separately called on the university's donors to withhold their funding unless the school condemns the pro-Palestinian protests.
The climate is hostile. The climate is unsafe. The climate is in a violation of the principle of free speech that universities usually take pride of. We have seen what is called the Palestinian exception, where you're allowed to protest any other issue, but when it comes to Palestine, there is an exception that you should not and you're not allowed to protest. And if you do protest, they will hit with an iron fist, which we are seeing unfolding right now at Columbia campus.
Mohsen is not one of the students who says he was chemically sprayed on January 19th. But he still had a scary experience that day.
A counter-protester knew who I am, called me by name, and he walked directly towards me, and he issued a death threat, and he told me, Mohsen Mahdawi, I will take your life, I will kill you. And I looked at him and I said, what's triggering you? What are you scared of? And then he physically moved even further to basically wave his arm in front of me, and he called me a Nazi in front of public safety.
That's what Columbia calls its on-campus security presence.
They allowed the perpetrator to get away without citing him, without taking his ID, and without holding him accountable while they saw the whole scene. It was a shock because we come to Columbia University in order to enter the sphere of debate and conveying our feelings and thoughts in a respectful manner. Everything we were doing, it was a peaceful means in protest. And now at Columbia University, at the place where I was supposed to feel most safe and protected to protest, to share my thoughts, to share my pain and grief, I was threatened to be killed just for protesting and sharing my voice.
Mohsen grew up in a refugee camp in the occupied West Bank, and what he experienced on January 19th was all too familiar.
It really brought up old feelings. I have faced, as a child, death threats before that are actual, where I was shot at, and I thought it is an irony that I made it all the way from a refugee camp, and I might lose my life in a place that is supposed to be safe.
That assurance of safety was something he was specifically looking for when he came to the U.S.
Life in the refugee camp was tense and painful and difficult. The most painful part of it was living under the Israeli occupation, and for me as a child to witness beloved one being killed on the hands of Israeli soldiers. When I was 11 years old, I lost my uncle. When I was 12 years old, I lost my best friend. I witnessed an explosion that killed 7 people and shattered them into pieces. And when I was 15 years old, I was shot in my leg. And this is the life that I lived through and what my family went through, a life of loss and grieving beloved ones.
Mohsen has only suffered more personal loss in Israel's ongoing assault on Gaza.
Since October 7th, I have lost more than 20 members. We cannot really count at this point of my extended family in Gaza. I lost 2 cousins, Hikmat and Muhammad, in the refugee camp. One is 17 years old and the other is 24. Hikmat, he sticked his head out of an alley when the occupation forces were coming to camp, and directly he was shot in his head. When Muhammad, his older brother, learned that his brother was shot and on the ground, he went to basically bolt him, to drag him back to the alley, and the moment he arrived, his body, he was shot directly in the head, and he was killed on the spot over his brother. It's a painful reality of Palestinians. Almost every Palestinian family has experienced this loss at this point, with the level of murder that the Israelis are committing.
More after the break.
Get your news in less than 3 minutes, 3 times per day with the Al Jazeera News Updates. Just ask your home device to play the news by Al Jazeera or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Mohsen Mahdawi left the occupied West Bank for the U.S. when he was 23, and with his travels came a newfound sense of security.
I was an activist for freedom in Palestine, but really I did not know what freedom tastes like and looked like until I came to America. The freedom of being able to sleep in your home in safety and security without having the Israeli army coming and breaking into the house. The freedom of driving from point A to point B without worrying about checkpoints. The freedom of going to the ocean and seeing nature and be able to hike. All of these Palestinians don't have.
After those experiences, Mohsen made a decision. He wanted to get an education in the U.S. and use it to highlight what his family was going through on the other side of the world.
And I thought the best way is to go to a respectful university such as Columbia University. And when I decided to go to Columbia, I applied based on my experience as a Palestinian refugee an experience that's worth to be shared and to be heard and to be looked at. And that's what Colombia accepted me for, in order to share my experience that represents millions of Palestinians.
But now, given the atmosphere in the U.S., Mohsen says he doesn't feel safe as a Palestinian activist, whether that's on campus at Columbia or elsewhere.
The death threat that I received are grounded by a reality that three Palestinian students in Burlington around Thanksgiving were shot in the street just for having kufiyas, Palestinian scarves, and for speaking Arabic.
The students were visiting the family of one of the students over the Thanksgiving holiday. They say a man walked up to them and shot them without saying a word.
So the situation in America is scary. I believe that this threat is not disconnected from the threat that our people, as Palestinian people, are going through, and the daily deaths and killings that are taking place in Palestine, in Gaza, and in the West Bank.
Mohsen points out that throughout U.S. history, universities have been places where justice movements have taken root and led to change.
Those movements, similar to Vietnam War and to the movement against apartheid in South Africa, they tend to shape the narratives of the country.
Since Israel's war on Gaza began, Mohsen has been interviewed by countless publications. That includes our colleagues at AJ Plus. He's also been interviewed by his peers, like Chris Mandel.
I'm a staff writer for the Columbia Daily Spectator.
That's Columbia's daily newspaper. Chris has been heavily involved in the Spectator's coverage of the discourse around Gaza on campus. But he's relatively new to the university's journalism scene.
This past fall was my first semester on Spectator. My own school is underrepresented in Spectator. We're a group of non-traditional students, and a lot of the time, Spectator's made up of traditional age students. So I was really looking forward to telling the voice of my fellow students at my school. Obviously, that's morphed quite a bit since the conflict in Gaza has began, but I feel like I'm still telling the stories of my peers.
Over the course of the semester, several major news outlets have covered the tensions at Columbia over U.S. policy towards Israel's war in Gaza.
Columbia University, massive crowds as supporters of both Israel and Palestinians held competing protests.
Columbia, open the door!
But Chris believes student journalism is able to offer an insight those bigger outlets can't.
And I think an advantage that we have as student journalists is that we're reporting on our peers. We understand the nuance of discussions, we understand the entire scope of what's going on, and we have a lot more context than other outlets might have. We also have a network at this school, so my friends know other people, and I'm able to tap into them, and I'm able to ask them, hey, do you know about this person? Or hey, what do you know about this event coming up? And I'm really able to source from all these different areas.
Chris says that makes him more effective. And that was never more apparent than after the protest on January 19th.
It was the first protest back after winter break, and I wanted to meet with my sources to kind of reopen those channels. And after attending the protest later that night, I heard that there were allegations that protesters were stink bombed or something like that happened. So I began to look into it independently. I basically requested footage that Spectator had taken that day so I could comb over the footage and zoom in and see if I could see anything unusual. And this is about the time where reports of people going to see the doctor and police reports, those were coming in at about that time. So I really went into overdrive. I was texting and calling people as much as I could. I was requesting footage from students who were there that I know were there. And I was trying to get as many testimonials as I could from people who were there so I could understand the scope of what people saw, what people heard, what people smelled. the story continued to rapidly develop. I kept interviewing people, I kept getting documentation from people. And then with a team of editors, we went line by line by line editing the story to make sure that everything we were saying, there was no doubts about it.
They looked over reports from nearly 24 students and were among the first news outlets to report on what happened. It was a difficult story to cover, one that required a lot of precision and a lot of care with the facts. But that story is not the only difficult part about covering the tensions at Columbia.
So this has definitely been an emotional topic to cover. Since the first protest I covered on November 9th until today, I've spent countless hours talking to people on the phone and trying to understand the scope of the situation. I've had multiple phone calls where people are crying and people are letting me know that they don't feel heard, that they're sad, they're depressed, they're scared. And it breaks my heart because these are my peers. These are college-age kids trying to figure themselves out. These are people seeing something happen that they don't agree with and they want to let their voices be heard. They deserve to have support and care.
Mohsen also thinks he and his fellow students need their stories to be told.
My story is supposed to be valued, to share a side that not many students have been exposed to. Universities are basically the living ideologies of the country, and I call them like the brain of America. And you get a whole generation, a new generation in universities who are seeing the reality for what it is. And mainstream media that used to control the perception of people are no longer succeeding.
Coming up tomorrow, part two, the encampment.
We were released. We have a summons for trespassing. I'm trespassing on a university that I'm paying tens of thousands of dollars a year to go to. How? It doesn't make sense. It really doesn't make sense.
And that's The Take. This episode was produced by Ashish Malhotra with Chloe K. Lee, Saril Khalili, Amy Walters, Nagin Oliayi, Khalid Sultan, David Enders, Sonia Bagat, Zaina Badr, Veronisa Campana, Catherine Newhan, Manahil Navid, and me, Malika Bilal. Our sound designer is Alex Roldan. Alexandra Locke is The Take's executive producer, and Nay Alvarez is Al Jazeera's head of audio. We'll be back tomorrow.